Blog Talk Radio.
And hello out there to all you Brooklyn folk. This is Sam Maxwell, and you are here with the Bedford and Sullivan podcast. And we are trying to redo the Brian Sidney Parrott episode, which we got plenty of amazing stuff, luckily, with about an hour and 5 minutes, if you all want to check it out, if you have not heard it. But Brian should be joining us soon. He is the son of Harold Parrott, who was the beat writer for the Brooklyn Eagle and the Dodgers for I believe it was 15 years, and then he became the traveling secretary and publicist for the Brooklyn and Los Angeles Dodgers. And it is it was fascinating to talk with him, but unfortunately we got cut off. And actually, let me explore some of that, because I'm a little frustrated with Blog Talk Radio and the way that I've been trying to get these episodes off. I just recently moved to Denver about 2 months, 3 months ago, and they have it that you need to reset your time zone, which I discovered on the last podcast, and that was certainly my fault. But I reset the time zone today before making the episode that we're currently listening to, and I changed it to the appropriate one, and it still made it for 2 hours from now. I basically wanted to keep it on the East Coast, so I changed it back to the East Coast and then started creating the episode, and unfortunately it didn't match, and I didn't notice it until at the last second. So that is certainly on me, and it is certainly on me to – I understand how it could probably take a while sometimes for the system to register, and then it's going to set it for 1 o'clock central time, 1 o'clock mountain time, because I had just changed it back to New York. But at the same time, this is twice that I've had issues with the time zones and Blog Talk Radio. And even though I thought I went through the appropriate measures this time, they still ended up screwing me with the episode that I originally tweeted out. And I just wanted to approach that and explain to everybody out there why there has been such an issue over the last little bit, this last week, about what time this whole thing was going to take off. And now that I have Brian, I will direct it directly to Brian. Brian, I appreciate your patience and help through all of this, and we're finally on, and we're going to be having a good show. We're taking off now.
Good, Sam. Yeah, not to worry. It's fine. I know the time zones can be tricky, I guess, but yeah, I'm ready to go as wherever you want to.
Well, actually, I want to go wherever you feel we left off, and I wanted to just kind of put the ball back into your court, and let's just take it from there.
Well, I listened to the whole show, and several friends of mine did, and they enjoyed it. I think we kind of left off with some of the Walter O'Malley, you know, pulling the trapdoor on Harold Parrott, but it was explained really by Buzzy Bavese that Dad was so close to Branch Rickey that it was only a matter of time until O'Malley would let him go. So I'll just finish, you know, a little bit of Dad went to work for Gene Autry and a Mr. Reynolds, I'm trying to think of his first name, and opened Anaheim Stadium in 1965 or whatever that first year was, and handled season ticket sales and promotions. And I asked him about that, and he said, matter-of-factly, well, I set up a meeting with Walt Disney, and I said, you met Walt Disney, which I had not known, and I was 40 years old at the time. He said, yeah, I wanted to ask if he would send over Mickey Mouse and Minnie and Goofy and the characters so kids could get their pictures taken with the Disney characters. And Walt Disney said, well, I could do better than that. He said, how about if I shut Disneyland down for the day and anybody that buys a ticket to your opening game will get free admission to Disneyland? And Dad said, would you actually do that? And he said, yes, I want you to be successful. So they did. It sold out immediately, I think 58,000. and that was a great start for Angel Baseball. But Walt Disney was quite a promoter. So he was there, and then I was up in Seattle playing tennis for Seattle U and getting an education. And Marvin Milks was with the Angels. He went up to be the general manager for the Pilots. And Dad, you know, was asked by Marvin Milks to come up and help open up the new American League franchise in Seattle and the Seattle Pilots. And so Dad left a great job and went up on a handshake to Seattle. And large part, I think, because I was up there, he liked watching me play tennis, and he was up for new challenges. On the fourth day of the season, the owner, Dewey Soriano, said, "I'm sorry, I can't afford your salary," and let him go. And Dad, you know, said it was, you know, he got screwed there too, unfortunately. And he tried to explain to Bowie Kuhn that, you know, this guy was underfunded and, you know, really there was another group that wanted to take over the Pilots. But in any event, that failed in 1 year and was sold for $1 million to Milwaukee, to Bud Selleck. There was a group in Seattle led by a man with United Airlines that offered $12 million to the American League, but they would have been more a group instead of one owner. And American League turned that $12 million down for $1 million to Bud Selleck.
The thing about the Pilots, what I love from my angle and from the National League New York side of it, is that the 1969 New York Metropolitan, it's the only World Series trophy with the Seattle Pilots pennant.
Now, I'm not following that. How did the Pilots – say that again.
By the pennant, I mean that the World Series trophy has a golden flag for every team in the entire major leagues. And the Seattle Pilots, who only existed in 1969, the Mets trophy is so unique that it's the only one with the Seattle Pilots flag.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize that. Yeah, that's right. 1969.
Right, yeah. People don't even think about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, people don't even think about it like that. It is fascinating that your dad made his way up to that and to be part of such a unique situation for, you know, in baseball history, considering they only had 1 year, and I'm not even sure what their record was, and nobody, you know, I'm sure in Seattle it's kind of like there's a little bit of nostalgia for it, but I'm sure it's very minimal.
Yeah, I don't know what their record was either. You know, again, it was in Seattle. Sick Stadium was actually the name. Emil Sick was the owner of the Pacific Coast League franchise prior to you know, the Seattle Rainiers, and Emil Sick, it was called Sick, S-I-C-K, apostrophe S, Sick Stadium, and it was a Sick Stadium. It was pretty old, and, you know, of course, I went to a few games there. But anyway, then Dad, Buzzy Bavese, now, for those that listened to the first podcast, Buzzy knew that Walter had let Dad go on false premises, and Buzzy created a position for Dad in San Diego with the Padres. He had left O'Malley and was running the Major League San Diego franchise, San Diego Padres, and Dad went down there for several years with Buzzy, and so he finished his Major League career there. I think Buzzy never told Dad what O'Malley had done with Peter Pitchess and the sheriff checking his bank account, but I think Buzzy must have felt a little bit guilty, or not guilty, but just knowing Dad got screwed at the Dodgers, he helped him out with a spot at the Padres. And anyway, it turned out to be a bit of a rough situation. Buzzy's son, one of them, started telling Dad, "When are you going to retire, you old MF?" And it was a bad deal. I didn't realize how bad it was, but my brother called me and Todd and said, "We got to get Dad out of San Diego. What can we do?" I wound up suggesting he become the first executive director for the Pacific Northwest Tennis Association, which they hired him, and he did for 10 years. And so he was back up in Portland. We had a lot of fun. But I got to hear lots and lots of stories, obviously, from Dad during that period of time, too.
Well, was some of your motivation was the idea that by the time the Padres, by the time, you know, you had gone around to the Padres, it just baseball wasn't working out anymore. And was part of the idea just like moving on to a different sport? And also, I have a follow-up question with Portland after you're done with that.
Well, I think, you know, I think Dad would have stayed at the Padres, but it was when my brother said he's in a bad situation, he didn't tell me how Buzzy's son was attacking Dad and trying to get him to quit. And anyway, so it was a bad situation, and he always loved tennis. You know, as a sports writer, he had covered the grass court circuits in the 30s and was a founding member of the U.S. Tennis Writers Association, and that's part of why he got me involved in tennis when we moved to California with the Dodgers in the 50s, late 50s, and so I just thought it was a logical suggestion that we were, the Pacific Northwest was the last section of the United States Tennis Association of 17 sections. There was no executive director, no office, and so I went up to the meeting and I said, "I've got somebody, I think it's time, and he's overqualified for the position, but he'll do a great job." And they hired Dad, and that was 10 fun years working together.
That's fantastic. And so this was in Portland?
Yeah, he was based in Portland, but he was in charge, executive director for the Pacific Northwest Tennis, which was Oregon, Washington,
right,
top half of Idaho, British Columbia, and Alaska. Hmm. So it was geographically the largest section because of Alaska, but we were the smallest section in terms of population.
Right, right, of course. And so all this time, and without obviously going too far down that rabbit hole, since it's, of course, not the subject matter, I know that there was an interesting story coming out of AAA baseball in Portland at the time. And I forget what the name of the team was, but apparently it was a bunch of ragamuffin guys who kind of took Portland baseball by storm.
Yeah, the Mavericks. Bing Russell was the lead Maverick, and his son, the actor, Kurt Russell, played for them. And they were just rough and ready, great. It was like single A, I think. But whatever it was, you know, Portland was a terrific baseball town. Dale Murphy, I mean, there's a lot of history out of Portland. And since the Beavers, that there was a spot there for the Mavericks to jump in. And anyway, that's the Mavericks were a good baseball story in Portland for a while.
I think for all of you who have Netflix, there is a documentary that I believe Netflix purchased, which would mean it should be there all the time if it's a Netflix show, a Netflix documentary. But it's about the story of the Portland Mavericks. And what was it, Bing Russell, you said? That was the father's
Bing
name?
Russell
was
the, sort of the lead man there. And Kurt Russell, the actor, played for them, played for his dad.
So it's a really, really cool documentary that I suggest every baseball fan out there check out. But let's wrap back around. So at this point, you're moving along, of course, with Harold and the Dodgers, with your father and the Dodgers. And so when you first left Brooklyn, when you first left the Northeast, what was your feelings on that?
Well, we moved into a place in Rockaway in New York, Rockaway Beach, where we were close to the Atlantic Ocean, I mean, probably 100 yards. And the mom and dad scouted Southern California, and they came up with this place, Malibu. Malibu Colony was specifically we moved in there and rented a house just to see if we would like it. And it was Malibu Movie Colony, and it was amazing. Hollywood, you know, Lana Turner was in there, and James Mason. Our best friend was Jack Warden, the actor who did a lot of stuff, 104 movies, but in Shampoo and Heaven Can Wait. But Lee Marvin, I mean, it was like my brother Lynn said, celebrity overload. Next door to us was the Lawrence Welk announcer, Mr. Robertson. Lawrence Welk came by to visit once, and they brought Grandma in to meet him, and that was a big deal. So we're living in Malibu Colony, and Dad says to me, he said, I'd like you to take some tennis lessons. And I go, like, what is this? And I had never seen tennis. And so I said, Dad, I'm not interested. I'm going to be Luis Aparicio II. I didn't say that exactly, but I was a shortstop, and I was good. And I wanted to, you know, I played Little League baseball and was on an all-star team. And I had no interest in tennis whatsoever. But I took the lessons. And the man showed me the grips and, you know, and he said, you know, you could be good at this if you decided. And I said, well, you know, he said, have you practiced? I said, no, I haven't. There's the only person to play with is my brother Peter, and I hate losing to him. So I'm not, you know, I didn't practice. But when I got into high school, it was 1,000 boys, Loyola in Los Angeles, and it was an athletic factory. And I saw a 15-year-old named Stan Smith play against one of our players on our high school team. And I thought, there's more to this than I realized, because they got to travel on their own on the weekends up to Bakersfield, and they got all free rackets and cool jackets. So I started getting serious about it in high school, and then wound up getting really into it in my junior year, and I won the National Public Parks Championship and got scholarship offers then to colleges. So tennis became a great vehicle for me. And Dad must have realized I wasn't that big. I was about 90 pounds going into high school and 120 when I graduated. So I was small but fast and coordinated. So tennis turned out to be a great sport for me.
And speaking of which, going back to your life and your childhood, I kind of want to go down the culture road of the era a little bit. And you were born in 1947. In fact, it turns out you were born a month before my mother. And
okay.
So I was wondering that, or were you into music? Were you into movies? And when did that stuff, that kind of part of American culture start coming into your mind, if at all?
Well, I was into music because I was a singer. I could listen to Elvis Presley like three times, and then I'd have the song. And I used to sing constantly, again, for the Dodgers when they came by, or Company came by our house, like the Pee Wee Reese Cheating Heart and all this. So anyway, we moved to Los Angeles into Malibu, and one of my classmates was Nelson Riddle Jr., was the great conductor, Nelson Riddle. And Skip Riddle was a piano player. And then another classmate was Dennis Dragon, who was a drummer. And he was the younger brother of the captain and the captain and Tennille, and the son of a great conductor, L.A. Philharmonic, Carmen Dragon. So I was playing the guitar at the time, Spanish classical guitar. I was taking lessons. And we tried to form a group. And we met and practiced, and I thought, you know, with drums and a piano, they can't really hear my guitar, so I should have said, forget the guitar, let me sing, because I could have sung. And so music has always been part of my life. I loved singing, and I got to meet at the Dodger games Nat King Cole. One night, the Giants were playing, and Nat King Cole had come out with a single, Goodnight Little Leaguer was the name of the song. It was one side of the single. And then I was throwing balls in from the outfield with my Dodger uniform, number 14, Gil Hodges. It was actually Lynn's uniform and that I got to use when, you know, it fit me. And then Dad said they want to take pictures. They need a Little Leaguer for this promotional poster with Nat King Cole. So they took all kinds of pictures with me and Nat King Cole and Willie Mays and all this other stuff. And they wound up using that for Capitol Records for the poster, which I have a copy of. And I showed it to Natalie Cole when she came to Portland several years ago, and she signed it. But anyway, I loved music, but you know, I was always following it, but I never got into it officially, but just continued to sing karaoke and, you know,
Do you think that you were basically 3, 4, 5 when doo-wop was starting to come into prominence, and especially being in New York City. What was
right.
that? Was that any influence on you?
Well, I remember as a kid, when I was little, when I was 4, 5, 6, 7 years old, my brother Lynn, particularly, and his girlfriend that became his wife, Dottie, they used to take me to their parties, and it was just like happy days, you know, they're all dancing, and it was, you know, the 1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock rock, and it was, that was New York, was, there was a lot, a social scene in St. Francis de Sales, and then Lynn and Todd went to Brooklyn Prep, so yeah, that was all going on, too. And there's really no kind of music I don't like, but that was going on.
Right,
and then
me neither.
California was the Beach Boys. That was huge when that came out. I've followed it all and loved listening to all the great music of the 60s, 70s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, and so anyway, but I don't have a strong connection to it other than I did have an audition at Capitol Records for a commercial. And again, it must have been Dad that told them. He must have found out that they were looking for somebody on a commercial for a jingle for Mr. Bubble. Mr. Bubble bubbles your troubles away. So I go in.
Do you remember it?
Oh, yeah. Mr. Bubble bubbles your troubles away. And I was... And they said, you know, we're sorry, but we need a squeaky kid's voice. Your voice is too developed. I did not get the part, but I saved the check. It was a $1 check, 1959.
So what I'm wondering, do you remember the jingle and can you perform it right now?
Well, I remember the lyrics was Mr. Bubble bubbles your troubles away, but I don't remember the actual jingle. I'm sorry.
Okay. I figured I might as well try, right?
Sure.
So we're gonna jump back even further. We're talking about 1959. So let's go back to the 30s. What was it like for your father being a beat writer for not only a New York baseball team in the 30s, but the Brooklyn Dodgers?
Well, he loved to write. My father was, you know, just loved writing. And he was, you know, with his command of the English language that he had, he could write very colorfully. And in the 30s, going through his scrapbook, I saw interviews he did with Babe Ruth. And one, you know, I think it was 38 or 39 when the Giants and the Yankees were in the World Series, he ghosted for Lou Gehrig and Carl Hubble in the same World Series, you know, their take on the World Series, whatever year that was. And he was a prolific contributor to the Sporting News. J.G. Taylor Spink was the publicist or the publisher of the Sporting News. And he called my father Bonfire, or some other writer had called him Bonfire and the Bonfire of Brooklyn. And, Mr. Spink was, you know, called Dad for a story on this or that, and would send him wires. Bonfire, give me this story and whatever. And he was picking up not only his Brooklyn Eagle check, but he was making some money writing for the Sporting News as well as magazine articles. He did one One was a classic about Leo DeRocher and Eddie Stanky. And it really, the title of, and I have a copy of the cover, it was for the Saturday Evening Post, Stinky Stanky Drives Wild Men Wilder was the title, that was the head. And the subhead was, he can't hit, he can't throw, and he can't run, but Judas Priest, how he can annoy. DeRocher ranks him more valuable than Roger Hornsby at his peak, you know. And so it was an article, you know, and he would pick up, you know, $500 to $1,000 for magazine articles that he would do. So he was in his prime pumping out stories constantly for the Eagle, sporting news, magazines, and, you know, and he was, you know, a prolific writer. One writer, Sam, in Chicago, Jerome Holtzman, who became the historian for Major League Baseball for Bud Selleck. When I called him, I said, Mr. Holtzman, we're going to republish Dad's book, Lords of Baseball, and I'd like to know if you would write a new foreword. And he said, I'd be happy to, and he immediately accepted. He said, and I said to him, I said, just out of curiosity, why did you invite Dad to be in your book, No Cheering in the Press Box, which he had put together writers doing chapters, No Cheering in the Press Box, Jerome Holtzman. And Mr. Holtzman said, your father was an obvious choice. He was one of the top baseball writers of the 20th century. He said, I'm sorry I got to take another phone call, but let me know if you find a publisher. And, you know, he had to hang up. But his dad was highly respected and loved writing. And, you know, and I don't think he really wanted to give up his writing when Mr. Rickey asked him to become the traveling secretary in the fall of 43.
Right, exactly. And did he continue to ghostwrite?
Yes, he did. In fact, one, he wrote two books in his life, and one was a ghostwritten. It says The Dodgers and Me by Leo DeRocher. And Dad wrote that after one of the seasons when Leo was the manager. And I happened to ask him about the tape. And, Sam, I'm trying to see if I can get that tape converted so I can share it with you when I ask Dad about all of his, much of his history. And Dad said, yeah, it was following a season, and they wanted a book in 3 weeks. And Dad said, I managed to provide. He wrote The Dodgers and Me by Leo DeRocher, and Dad wrote the book. So he continued to ghost, yes. And it makes me think of another Howard Cosell story. Dad saw Howard Cosell in San Diego, and they hadn't seen each other in 20 years or something long. And I asked Dad about that, and he said Howard Cosell didn't just say hello. He said, the author of The Dodgers and Me, a book for which you received little of the credit, was your due. Harold, how are you? And that was the way Cosell said hello. So,
and that was not live on television, right? That was in person, just privately, right?
That was privately.
Brilliant. And then, by the way, that was a good. That was both you, Branch Rickey, and your Howard Cosell are excellent. So I want you to tell the Larry McPhail story, because obviously, you know, I think a lot of times we can assume everybody knows this stuff, but we got to assume that there's always somebody who does not know it. That's why Joe DiMaggio, as he used to say, would play with such vigor every day, because somebody out there has not seen him. So, before we get into Larry McPhail's story, I was hoping you could pull another story out of the Lords of Baseball hat regarding your father, and specifically, if you could, during his beat years.
Well, I remember one that always struck me funny was Wilbert Robinson was the manager of the Dodgers and had been a manager for like 20 years. And I don't know if it was McPhail or not, but Hack Wilson was brought to the Dodgers, and he had hit like 59 home runs one year, you know, in the American League, and was 55 at least. But anyway, Dad said he was a short, barrel-chested guy with size 5 shoes, but he could, you know, pull out the home runs. But he was a heavy drinker. And Dad said Wilbert Robinson was trying to set a new tone for the Dodgers, and at the opening meeting, or one of the early meetings in the Dodger year, Wilbert Robinson brought a glass of water and a glass of gin and a garden worm. And the garden worm was put into the water, and he said, "Gentlemen, I'd like to see what you learned from this little experiment." And he puts the worm in the water, and then it wiggles around, and then he puts the worm in the gin, and within a few moments, the worm is dead. And he said, "Do you learn anything from that, gentlemen? Mr. Wilson, you learn anything from that?" And Hack Wilson said, "I sure do, Skip. He said, if you drink gin, you'll never get worms." So I always thought that was a funny, true story. But Dad would cover, stories and write about things. And covering the Dodgers with McPhail, of course, McPhail was a heavy drinker. And I think the story you want me to tell, and there's greater detail in the Lords of Baseball about it, but Dad wrote something Larry McPhail didn't like, and when Dad was at the Ebbets Field, McPhail punched him in the nose and banned him from Ebbets Field for life, you know. So Dad went back to the Eagle, and they weren't going to let that happen, but it all smoothed over. I don't recall what he had written that McPhail didn't like, but McPhail was pretty spontaneous there, I guess. And
while we talk about it, while we talk just generally, I'll see if I can hunt it down in everything.
Yeah.
In terms of what the specific thing written, and probably I can go to Frank Graham's book, because that was one of the more definitive Brooklyn Dodger histories written at that time, and I'm pretty sure
right.
It was like. Not even written. I think I'm pretty sure it came out before 1941, or came out just right after that. And he wanted to kind of recollect the last era, which was basically just ending as they were becoming good again. But
now, Sam, while you look at that,
yeah.
I've got you mentioned Frankie Graham, and Dad told me another story about Frankie Graham and Leo Durocher and Dad, and it's really it's a good one, and bears. Repeating, Leo was the manager of the Dodgers. Dad was the traveling secretary, but still writing for the Eagle, which I think is amazing, that he was a journalist at the same time he was on the Dodger payroll. But anyway, they were on the dugout steps, and Frankie Graham said, it's a shame the Giants are doing so poorly under Mel Ott, and he's such a nice guy, And so the three of them were standing there, just the three of them. And, Leo says, "Yeah, Mel Ott is a nice guy," he said, "but he's got no control of that club." He said, "They're coming in at all hours." And he said one of their players showed up at the game in a full tuxedo. He'd been out all night. And Leo was making the point that Mel Ott was – had lost control of his ball club. And so Graham says he's such a nice guy. And then Leo's response, which was written by Frankie Graham first and Harold Parrott in his column, was, "Yeah, but in this league, nice guys are going to finish last." And so Dad wrote that in his column, and Graham wrote it in his, and it became the handle, for Leo Durocher, "Nice guys finish last," and misinterpreted to think that, you got to be, you can't be a nice guy and win. But what really Leo was talking about was discipline, and you're not gonna do well without discipline on a club or a team or whatever. So I think that's
I found it, by the way.
Frank, what's that?
I found it.
Great.
It was the first Harold Parrott part of the index. It's literally the first pages that your father comes up on. So I will read the paragraph real quick.
Okay.
We don't have to go too deep into it, but it definitely ends basically with Ford Frick. So for all of you readers out there, the Brooklyn Dodgers, an informal history, Frank Graham, and it's something that basically ends right before the next golden era of Brooklyn Dodgers history and right before they left. So, page 173, Brooklyn Dodgers and informal history, Frank Graham. Harold Parrott of the Eagle, looking over some out-of-town newspapers, came across a Milwaukee paper carrying a story which set forth that the president of the Milwaukee club was threatening to demand the return of Whit Wyatt. I think Whitlow Wyatt, right? That's his name?
Yes.
Whitlow Wyatt. McPhail, according to this story, had not yet come through with four players he had promised Milwaukee as part of the deal, although demands for them had been made upon him since the opening of the season. This, of course, was news in Brooklyn since Wyatt rapidly was becoming a favorite at Ebbets Field. Parrott rewrote the story, and it was slapped on the front page of the Eagles' first edition. For the game that afternoon, he was on his way to the press box at Ebbets Field when McPhail suddenly lunged out of the milling fans in the back of the stands to confront him. "You bleeping liar," Larry roared. "You little Blake, blah, blah, blah." Probably son of a bitch, I'm guessing. Parrott's attempts to defend himself against the verbal onslaught were useless because when McPhail is angry, he leaves few openings for his opponent. He continued to berate Parrott at the top of his voice as a ring of curious fans gathered about them. "I'll have you barred from the park," he yelled. "I've got a good mind to have you thrown out now, you blank. I'll show you whether or not you can lie about me in your lousy paper. You never get into this ballpark again." Parrott, unable to make a stand before this blast, beat an orderly retreat in the direction of a telephone and called Ford Frick to give him a first-hand report of the battle and seek his advice. So the thing with Frank Graham, I heard, was that he never forgot a thing.
You mean McPhail?
No. Frank Graham, the writer,
yeah.
You know, when like you're considering how detailed it is, so apparently
yes.
He never forgot a thing.
No, and they were good friend, very good friends, Dad and Frank Graham. And he doesn't say that he punched Dad in the nose.
I mean, if that's the thing, though, if you're saying that, let me see. During that part, I read everything up to that part on page 174. Parrott, unable to make a stand before this blast, and yes, at some point it only talks about a verbal onslaught.
Yeah.
And then Ford just says, "Keep away from him for the rest of the afternoon. I'll get him on the phone as soon as I can to straighten him out, and I can assure you, you won't be barred from the park." So, so then obviously it says that, you know, Larry apologizes to him. But did the punch maybe happen afterwards? Maybe it's in a few pages?
No, all I know is Dad told me that McPhail punched him in the nose. And I don't know.
Maybe that was a separate incident.
I don't know. You know, all I know is that, you know, he was hot about something that Dad had written, and that's obviously what it was. And Whitlow Wyatt came in and, you know, did extremely well. But he, Ford Frick, that's amazing. Dad just immediately got on the phone.
You know,
Ford
maybe,
Frick.
Maybe Ford felt as if he needed to leave the violence out of the dramatics of the book.
Perhaps. And so,
because only from, like, if that's what he's thinking.
Yeah.
It definitely sounds like it was this thing. Like, it definitely sounds like this was the incident. And I think I've heard it written. I think I've heard it written other places, just obviously without the detail, maybe of the Whitlow Wyatt part. It has been written as there was a punch involved.
Yeah. Well, anyway, Dad told me that he did punch him, but the Ford Frick thing reminds me that when Branch Rickey came in to take over for McPhail when he was fired. Ford Frick gave Dad the tip, you know, and gave him the exclusive, and so Dad wrote about Ricky coming into Brooklyn in whatever year that was. And so Dad had a good relationship with Ford Frick, who I think was president of the National League at the time.
As a writer, did he ever need to have a relationship with Branch Rickey, even though Branch Rickey was in St. Louis?
No, he didn't. He covered the Dodgers, so he knew of Rickey, and Dad wrote an article for a magazine called This Week in 1941, and I have a copy of it, and it's called The Brain of Baseball, and about the brilliance of Rickey with the farm system, and I think basically it was a very positive piece about Rickey in 41, and so Dad knew of Rickey, of course, because of, you know, the Gas House Gang and Leo DeRocher and how they won, you know, how good they were in the 30s. And but I think when Rickey came to New York, he knew he had not a fan, but at least somebody that would write about him fairly. And so that's what, you know, the reason I believe he asked Dad to become the traveling secretary in the fall of 43, which he started in 44.
Yeah, that's it's remarkable. It must have been really remarkable and shocking for your father. And I know you told the story in the last podcast, but we might as well, you know, relitigate it. I think that it must have been a complete and, like, all of a sudden a fork in the road that your father was not expecting.
Say that again, a fork in the road that my father was what?
Oh, a fork in the road that your father was not expecting.
Oh, yeah. He wasn't expecting Rickey to ask him to become the traveling secretary. But Ricky's brilliance, not only did he get a traveling secretary, but he got a publicist that had connections with all the writers, which was very positive, and a writer. You know, he continued to write for the Eagle and magazines and Sport Magazine and Sporting News. And Ricky made a good deal in getting Harold Parrott to come to work for him as the traveling secretary in 1944.
Right. So let's delve deep into the 50s. Now, Walter O'Malley and Robert Moses are having conversations. Where's your father in all of this?
Well, the year that Rickey was forced out of the Dodgers by O'Malley, when O'Malley got controlling interest, whatever year that was, Sam, and you may know better than I, but I think it was around 50, Dad was asked to go to Pittsburgh with Mr. Rickey, and Rickey had outsmarted O'Malley in this, you know, with the sale of his shares. And that's quite a good story, and it's in the Lords of Baseball. Rickey had bought his interest in the Dodgers for, like, I believe around $250,000 when he came to Brooklyn. And then he proceeds to load up the Dodgers with a team that, you know, challenges, wins the pennant in 47, and anyway, when the confrontation, when O'Malley was trying to force Rickey out, he offered Rickey the same amount, like $250,000, for his shares, because he knew he had to sell them, and he had to sell them before he could go to Pittsburgh. So Rickey, there was a stipulation in the contract that if somebody offered more for the shares, that had to be matched. And so Rickey got a man named Zeckendorf, who was the builder of the Empire State Building, to offer Branch Rickey $1 million for his shares with the Dodgers. So O'Malley was faced with he either has a new partner in Zeckendorf or he buys the shares for $1 million and matches Zeckendorf's offer. So that's what O'Malley wound up paying the $1 million for the Ricky's shares. And while they had this going on, there was a $50,000 check to Zeckendorf for tying his money up. Maybe it was put in escrow or whatever. And when the check came back to O'Malley, the $50,000 check to Zeckendorf was endorsed to Branch Rickey. So Rickey not only got the $1 million, but he got the $50,000 on top of it. And when you think about Buzzy Bavese's comment, when it came to money, there was something wrong with Walter, that must be part of O'Malley's hatred of Rickey. He outsmarted him so well in that particular case. So Dad was asked by O'Malley to take over the business manager, ticket manager job. And Dad would have turned it down because he much preferred, you know, traveling secretary, partly because they got World Series share. The traveling secretary, I have a canceled stub of a check for $4,000 that Dad got in 1947. So when they were winning pennants, there was extra money coming in for the World Series share for Harold Parrott and the traveling secretary. So Dad told O'Malley he'd take the job, but he didn't want to give up the, you know, the share. And so O'Malley agreed to let Dad get a World Series share. And then after 1 year, he reneged on that and said to Dad, you know, how long did you think I was going to let that go on? But anyway, Dad became the ticket manager and, you know, handled all of the tickets at Ebbets Field for, you know, through 1957, and then had the same role in Los Angeles with the Dodgers when they were setting up in the Coliseum and then Dodger Stadium. So my father's role during that time with O'Malley, Rickey, and Moses was, you know, just as an executive, and, you know, I don't know that he had a particular role in that, but, and I knew, you know, I'm sure he was well aware of the animosity between O'Malley and Rickey.
And you hear something like that, you know, whether it be the reserve clause or whether it just be, you know, going back on your word, there seems to be this old school business, unethical way that, you know, of manipulating the system that was completely accepted for the longest time just because it's business is the saying. It's just business. And you still see some of that today, but ethics and not to say that, you know, Walter O'Malley shouldn't have done right by his business as one should, but where do you draw the line?
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, it's one of those.
And not necessarily whether it's really just talking about the broad way that Walter O'Malley handled himself when it came to money, not just the fact that it led the decision and that type of mindset led to the Dodgers leaving.
Yeah. I mean, only, you know, O'Malley made the move, and it was very successful and great for the kids in L.A. and terrible for the kids in Brooklyn.
But then again, you know, out of death comes life, and you're talking about the Mets. And even though they can be a mess, they're still, as far as I'm concerned, a lot more fun and exciting and less boring than their counterpart of New York, which is the entire point of National League Baseball in New York and what the Dodgers and the Giants represent.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, you know, when I think about the move, and I think about it in terms of how excited a city gets when a team wins a world championship. Well, the Dodgers were in the World Series 6 out of 10 years from 47 to 57, and won the World Series, of course, in 55. They were in the World Series in 56. They finished second to Milwaukee with Hank Aaron and Eddie Matthews and Del Crandall and Warren Spahn and Lou Burdett in 57. And they were gone in 58. So to have such a successful franchise ripped out of a city is really remarkable. And, I mean, it's that it happened, but it did. And so I think it was devastating for lots of people and reminds one of the story. If you were in a room with Stalin, Hitler, and Walter O'Malley, and you had a gun with only two bullets, what would you do with it? And the answer in Brooklyn is you shoot O'Malley twice.
Yeah, that's definitely just one that's just I love every time. It just eats up, and it's because you really do shoot Hitler and probably Stalin, but like in reality, you get the joke. You completely understand the joke,
right?
And at the same time, like the thing about it is that. You know, it is devastating, but you just think about the joy when, you know, the Mets are the only team, I believe, in the entire world to exist because two teams left. And so you think about the joy of getting a team back, and even though they were the worst team that modern era had ever seen, they also lost in very entertaining ways. They also always seemed to be right on the edge of not being that bad. And had they, if you really look at the numbers, had they come through at least like half the times that they were in a position to maybe either tie or go ahead, they probably would have been maybe a 90 or even better team, 90 loss or better team. So, you know, it's just funny because a lot of people say, you know, 5 years earlier, that team would have been pretty all right.
Yeah. Well, it is the Miracle Mets were great, and Gil Hodges had obviously a lot to do with that. And, you know, it's a great story that baseball, National League Baseball, came back to Brooklyn. But while we're on this the subject of dad writing and Walter O'Malley and Ricky and all that, in 1976, when Prager, which was the publishing company, gave dad $20,000 to write a book, and I might add, he suggested the title, The Boneheads of Baseball. And, you know, one of the lines that I don't know if it was dad's or he credited somebody else, but baseball must be the greatest sport to survive the men that run it. And anyway, the publisher didn't title the book the Boneheads of Baseball. They used the Dick Young Lords of Baseball phrase. And when Walter O'Malley found out that Harold Parrott was coming out with a book, I'm sure not knowing whether or not he had found out about Peter Pitches and all that other stuff, he didn't want a book written by Harold Parrott to be out in circulation. So Dad told me that O'Malley bought 12,000 copies. He bought the entire inventory from Prager. And my guess, and this is, again, Brian Parrott's speculation, he probably threatened them with a lawsuit if they went into a second printing. And so he bought the copies and kept them out of the bookstores in 1976. And it was reviewed by 103 dailies around the country and compared to Ball 4. Again, Jerome Holtzman said, for honesty, it is equal to, if not possibly surpasses, Ball 4. And anyway, when I was asking my dad at one point, I said, I don't understand why the book didn't do better. And he told me, well, nobody could buy it because it was not in the bookstores in 76 when it was reviewed. That's what prompted me to say to my brother, Todd, we got to republish. If there's any possible truth, we got to republish that. And so we republished The Lords of Baseball in 2001. And that's really, I'm thrilled that we did it. It was Todd put the money up, and I did the promotion with Sabre and sports talk shows and things like that to bring it back.
What I like about the title is that nobody ever said that Lords can't be boneheads. And so that's
right.
that's my take on it, is that's why it works, because they're still Lords of the game. They and you know, it's the content, it's the context, it's the content of the book that shows how boneheady they could be. And yeah, go ahead.
Dad, when our final book signing that year, or the 2 years we did it, the republishing, was at Cooperstown. And the author series manager said he just reread, he said it's really one of the best baseball books ever written. And so it's been a treasure trove for many. And I know that it was used for the movie 42, many of the scenes that were in there. And when the fellow that was selected to play Dad called me and he said, can I meet you and find out more? He said when he got the part, the screenwriter and director handed him The Lords of Baseball and said, your character wrote this book, so you should read this. And so obviously they used The Lords of Baseball for the movie 42, which is great. And it's a treasure trove for Sam Maxwell, too, because it's got all kinds of tidbits, you know, from McPhail to O'Malley to Ricky to Robinson, Reese, Hodges, and Newcomb, and everybody. So it's a great piece of history, and it's terrific that Dad did it. And the republishing, we put the proceeds into a foundation called the Bonfire Foundation. And Todd stocked it with some stock too, and it's apparently just under $1 million that's there, and it helps kids' education, you know, support for continued education, the Bonfire Foundation.
Well, that's fantastic, and if you want to elaborate on that and certainly tell people where they can go to give to that.
I think you can, you know, Google the Bonfire Foundation, and my niece and goddaughter, Heather, runs the foundation, and she handles all of the requests and things. But you can find it on the Bonfire Foundation, I think, has got a website.
Well, perfect. Yeah, just go to Google and type in Bonfire Foundation, and it should direct you to the website. These days, you don't even need to spell it all out, the website, so just tell them go to Google. So we're gonna wrap it up pretty soon, and so, you know, we usually go to the last word, Brian, when we don't get cut off by Block Talk Radio. I'm still giving them a little jab, but you know, it is what it is. It's a love hate relationship. We're family. So I'm gonna pass it to you for the last word. Whatever you want to wrap up this segment, you know, because you know these two last podcasts that can kind of be grouped together. For your father and for the Lords of Baseball.
Well, I want to encourage you, Sam. I think you're onto something with a series, and hopefully the HBO would be a good place for it to treat the history of you know, Brooklyn from 38 through 57. And again, Dad's work will provide you with a lot of additional insight and, you know, some copy, I'm sure, because the way he wrote it. I'm really happy that, you know, we republished The Lords of Baseball and more people got to enjoy it. And I would like to get it on tape and then continue to let people know that there's a book like that that's fun to read. It is. Dad had a great sense of humor and wrote very colorfully, but you know, it was a contribution to actual history, and I'm sure the more, you know, the history, the truth is stranger than any fiction, so the more truth that comes out about what happened with Brooklyn in those years, and how it literally changed the world. And it was a great group of people and very interesting characters. And I'll close by saying to my, you know, what I said to my dad when he said, how lucky I've been to be in the middle of all of this. And I said, well, Dad, that's true. But I said, they were lucky that you were there, because he had a lot to do with the whole Brooklyn Dodger mystique. I mean, from the late 30s or in the 30s through the 40s and you know, even into the 50s, even though he wasn't writing as much in the 50s. But his book, The Lord's Baseball, is a worthwhile read for anyone that is interested in that kind of history.
And I think the only way to end with that would be to say Google The Lords of Baseball, and you will find it on Amazon, or just Amazon The Lords of Baseball. Is it in e-reader form yet?
Is it in what form?
E-reader form, like Kindle.
No. I would talk to a publisher in New York about getting it on Kindle, but we haven't gotten it done yet.
Well, it's certainly a good idea, and I can't wait to – I mean, I'm going to read it regardless, considering that I have a hard copy right next to me as we speak. So, Brian, I will also say, and I appreciate the kind words, and I've thought I'm onto something, and I appreciate the audience being here and also having patience with this entire thing and understanding that the research process, especially the something – as ambitious as this, which could cost over $1 billion, theoretically, the way filmmaking and production works these days. You know, when we're talking about something like this, you can't have it be half-baked. You got to make sure that it's completely ready to go. And like I've said over the years, I couldn't have imagined being at this point without having lived in Brooklyn for the majority of my 20s. That was just unbelievable, and here I am in Denver off for a different journey. But what I kind of like in some fashion from from like a sign as to how what the Dodgers are and how this podcast is evolving and how the project is evolving. When you see how it got started with all these time zone weirdness and the way that Blog Talk Radio has it set up, you know, we can be the 1955 Dodgers while being the Daffiness Boys all at the same time. And that's kind of endearing to me that, you know, you go through failures, you go through mistakes, you go through ups and downs, but at some point you come out on top. And even, unfortunately, it might be ripped away from you at any point, but still there's that one moment, and thank God the Dodger community has that, and here we are still today talking about it, and hopefully we can show some people from a dramatic narrative standpoint at some point. And Brian, I thank you for helping me here right now, and I look forward to more help in the future.
All right, Sam, take care. Thanks again.
Absolutely, and thank you all for listening in, and tune in when next time. Well, we'll let you know. Take care.